Daphna Levy, relationship expert and author of Picking Right, The Single's Guide to Finding the Right Match. Today I'm speaking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom! Shalom, is this Daphna Levy?
This is she, Rabbi.
Oh, hello, hello, shalom, my dear. What a wonderful joy it is to have you on this radio program of the air, Dave's Gone By. I, of course, am Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And we are talking with Daphna Levy for a couple of different reasons. First of all, she is a relationship expert and a life coach, whatever that is, but it sounds like something I need. She has guested on all the major networks on TV and Fox, which is not a major network. Her book, Picking Right, which is a wonderful title because usually I just pick the left one and then my nose bleeds. But no, it's all about who you wind up with in your relationships, in your marriages, what to pick, what not to pick. And the other reason I really want to talk to Daphna Levy is that she is a Sabra, which means she was born in Israel, lived there for nearly the first 30 years of her life. She served in the military, even in the Yom Kippur War. So lots of things to talk about with Ms. Daphna Levy. Welcome to the neighborhood. Shalom.
Shalom. Thank you very much.
Oh, a pleasure to have you here. So, Daphna, explain, what is a life coach?
You know, I was a life coach long before life coaches were popular. So really, I'm a life consultant. I started in the 80s, and the life coach craze started in the 90s. So, from a life consultant, relationship consultant, I change it to life coach so that people will understand what I'm doing. But it's the same thing. I help people with advice about their life, with guidance, so they can do better.
Well, what do you tell people that they couldn't figure out from their own common sense?
You know, it really is all common sense. And sometimes people don't have common sense.
That's fair.
So you have to point out the obvious.
So what might be an example? You, obviously, you're not going to name names, but think of a couple or a person who went to you and said, oh, help, you know, I can't figure this out. And you said, da-da-da-da, boom, and their life got better.
Okay. There was a couple that came to me that were, they'd only been married for 2-3 years. They had a newborn, and they were at each other's throat. And I taught them a very simple principle. Your job as a couple is to help one another. Your job is to uplift each other, not bring each other down. That is actually your job. That's your job with every single person in your family. Uplift them, help them do better in life. And they started doing it, and the relationship improved.
But is something like that easier said than done, or was it simpler than they thought it would be?
No, it is easier said than done, but it can be done.
And we should say that you have earned the right, I guess, to talk about relationships, because I see sometimes when you're listed, there's a hyphen at there. You're Levy hyphen Hernandez. Are you married?
I am married. I have been married for 28 years.
Mazel. I mean, you didn't marry a Jew. This bothers me. How did you meet your husband?
I met him in L.A., you know. I came to L.A. and I met him, and he was a nice guy and a very, very fantastic person. He was not a Christian, per se.
Oh, okay.
A practicing. I don't think I could have married a practicing Christian. Just as a Jew, it would have been strange, and I know what you mean. I know that you understand me.
Oh, of course I do.
But he was, you know, he was sort of like a religionless.
Okay, well, yeah, I understand. I mean, he wasn't friends of mine who are Jewish. They're not in temple every Saturday. Although I send them threatening letters and say, you should be. And please join the sisterhood. We need the money. But do you have kids?
No, we don't have kids together. He has a son from an earlier relationship.
Okay.
So he's my son.
And is he your first husband? Were you married before?
You know, I was married before in my early 20s for about 4 years. Until my husband got tired of me.
Oh, well. Men.
I know, that happened.
Men. But what did you learn that you were able then to apply not only to your current marriage, but to the advice you give other people on their first marriages?
Well, I learned that you should not waste your time with somebody who does not appreciate you.
Mm.
Yemen. You know, I'm Yemeni, I'm olive skin. I'm like, if they love blonde, they should go find a blonde. They shouldn't go with me.
Oh, well, I mean, you can always dye your hair, but it's not the same, is it?
No.
Now, here's a question. I'm going to totally veer off course because you mentioned, like, a magic word this weekend. You mentioned Yemen, and it's all over the news right now. So tell me, what the hell happened to Yemen? You were there.
I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened to Yemen. My grandmother came to Israel from Yemen in 1910.
Wow.
While the Turks were still ruling Israel. And she came because they were very observant Jews. Their dream was to die in the Holy Land. That was the most honorable thing they could ever hope for. So they came to Israel. That was long before the magic carpet.
Explain what the magic carpet is, because that sounds like Aladdin and the Arabs. And
yeah, the magic carpet was when the government of Israel, after Israel had been established, actually sent airplanes to bring the rest of the Jews from Yemen to Israel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they came in, they got some assistance, and my grandmother didn't have that. She came on a rickety boat,
mm-hmm.
Yemen to Israel. She had one child died on the way. Two other children survived. Her husband died shortly after they had arrived in Israel. They had a very rough time, but they were in the Holy Land, and it meant everything for them.
So, but you have never been to Yemen. You just have a Yemenite background.
No, I don't think I can be with my Israeli passport. I mean, I have an American passport, but birthplace of Israel, I don't know that they would accept me in Israel, in Yemen.
Wow, so somehow Yemen has even gotten worse in 100 years. I know it was possible. We're talking with Daphna Levy here, who was born in Israel, when Israel was already established. You weren't born in Palestine, you were born in the country, it was already there, but it was pretty young. So what are your first memories as a child living in the Holy Land?
Well, I was born in Tel Aviv, but I grew up in a small town called Rehovot, which is about 20 miles south of Tel Aviv. I remember going to kindergarten. We could walk everywhere. As a little girl, like 3-4 years old, it was totally safe to go to walk down the street and walk even farther, go to school, go to kindergarten. I remember our street was not even paved when I was growing up.
Wow.
Yeah, it was not, in winter it would get muddy and so forth. Later on it got paved. And you know, it seemed so big to me then when I go visit. Oh my gosh, it's so narrow, it's so small, because the neighborhood I grew up in was the first Yemeni neighborhood in Rehovot. My grandmother was one of the founders of that neighborhood. So in the house that I grew up in was an adobe house.
Really?
It used to be a shul. And then my grandmother...
See, I had an Adobe Photoshop house, which was much more advanced at that point. Just kidding. Okay, so continue.
Yeah, my grandmother worked very hard to buy that house, because having a piece of land, that was everybody's dream. You have a piece of land, you have a roof over your head, and you have security. So yeah, it was an Adobe house.
But what I don't understand is, you're saying, I mean, this would have been the late 1950s, early 1960s, right? When you were a child and you felt safe.
I was born 1955.
Okay, right.
To reveal my age.
Oh, good for you. Good for you for not hiding, saying, oh, I was born this or sometime this, and you don't tell. A lady doesn't tell. A lady tells. You should be proud.
Oh, yeah.
But
I'm very proud. You know, this year I'll be 60. I don't feel 60. I don't look 60.
Nope.
Fantastic.
It is fantastic. But my question was about growing up and feeling safe. I mean, there was a war in 48, and then you had another war, well, in 67. There was something in between, too, right?
Yeah.
It's weird that you're saying you felt so safe.
Yeah, I know. First of all, it tells you never listen to the news. They lie.
Okay.
During war, obviously, you didn't feel safe in the sense that, like, those were the days of bombing. So when there was war, we used to cover the windows so the bombers couldn't see the towns, the cities.
Okay.
In that sense, during actual action and war, it was quite traumatic and uncomfortable. But during other times, I mean, sanctuary is completely safe. I mean, if I was there a few years ago, my sister and I walked in Tel Aviv on our own, two girls, at 1 a.m, you know, from one place to another. The place was humming. Clubs were open, restaurants, cafes, totally safe. Safer than L.A. at night.
Well, yeah, well, but if you're not worried about terrorists, how, is there much crime in Israel beyond that at all?
Not as much in the U.S. Oh. I haven't checked the statistics, but I don't think as much as the U.S.
So you went to school in Israel. Did you go to the, before the university, you finished high school there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were you bilingual? Did you have to learn English?
Yeah, in fifth grade, I think we started learning English, and then in high school, we added another language. You had a choice between French and Arabic, and I chose French.
Good for you. And then, it was mandatory, men and women, you had to go into the armed forces for, 2 years?
Yes.
How was it?
You know, first of all, growing up in Israel, you don't think of any other options. You don't think, I'm going to skip the military. The only way I could have skipped the military if I had lied and said that I was Orthodox, and I was not Orthodox.
Okay.
Because I was, you know, I was raised Reformed.
Let me interrupt you, because I this is a debate that's continuing to go on now in Israel. Do you think the Orthodox should serve in the IDF?
I think they should. It's their country, and they're being defended by the same military. Why should their children not contribute to this defense as much as the reform people?
And what is the reason on the other side why they shouldn't? It's not that they're pacifists by any stretch. Why do they think that they should not contribute?
I think that they supposedly cannot really observe the religion as strictly as they want to, but I think they're just egotistical, personally.
Okay, that's fair. So, you were in the, was it the Haganah or the IDF? I get them confused. What was the Haganah?
The Haganah was an early organization before the State of Israel was established.
Oh, so by the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was the IDF. Got it. Now,
yes.
Did you see any kind of combat?
No, I was never in combat. They keep women, in general, they keep women away from the line of combat. They usually serve in support roles, so because otherwise you would take a perfectly fit man and put him in the back lines to answer, telexes or a shuffle paperwork or whatever. So you have women doing these things, and this way there are more men, there is more manpower to go to the front lines.
I'm sure there are feminists who would kind of disagree with your thinking there, but I do understand it. But the reason I asked about combat is you were there during the Yom Kippur War. So do you have any memories or experiences of that?
Well, you know, I will never forget the first day of the Yom Kippur War. I was at my boyfriend's house, at his parents' house. He was my first boyfriend. I was about to... Yeah, I know.
So wait a minute, he made the earth move and it was really a bomb? No, I'm kidding.
That was cute.
Thank
you. So we were at his parents' house. I was going to join the military about 5 days later. And he was on Liberty for the weekend, I think. And suddenly, a military jeep stops by, and he was taken back to the base. We didn't know. We found out later that was the first day of the war.
Oh, so anybody, any able-bodied veteran or something, I got it. Wow.
Yeah. He happened to be doing his mandatory, you know, for men at the time it was 3 years. But he was on Liberty for a few days, and his Liberty ended abruptly. They came, picked him, he had a few minutes to pack his bags and drive away. And then 5 days later, I joined the military. That happened to be my draft day. to our training, because it was wartime, the girls packaged food for the soldiers.
Oh, makes sense.
And there's actually an interesting story there, because they encouraged us to put little notes in the food packages, so that those guys, you know, there was the Sinai Desert then, you know, the war was raging in the Sinai Desert, and they encouraged us to put little notes, so I wrote 5 notes, and I randomly put them in packages. This was, my boot camp was 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And for about a month, we did not hear from my boyfriend. His parents, we did not know if he was alive or dead. For me, as an 18-year-old, it was quite traumatic. I mean, you can imagine, I mean, anybody in your life that you're sitting there thinking, are they alive or dead? It's quite traumatic, but here it is. Your first love, your first boyfriend, is he alive? Is he going to come back? Is he going to come back at all? Is he going to come back without limbs? And when I finally heard from him, come to find out, one of my 5 notes reached him.
Oh, wow. And did he make it out okay? Was he...
Yeah, he was okay, thank God. He was okay. He came back, and, you know, the war was over. And it's the way it is in Israel. You know, there is war, and then it's over, and it's business as usual. People are kind of callous. They get used to it. They're tough.
Well, they have to be. I mean, look what's going on all over the world. I mean, having the experience of living in that country, what are your thoughts on how the hell do we control and deal with Arab Muslim terrorists?
Hi. You know, exactly. That's a tough one. These guys are so brainwashed. They are... They're so illogical and unreasonable. They cut their nose despite their face. Anybody who would send their children to detonate themselves to, you know, kill somebody else. It's like Golda Meir once said, on the day that they love their children more than they hate us, we can have peace.
That's right. I remember that. I remember her saying that.
But
let me ask you about the non-terrorists, because there are a lot of Arabs in Israel who aren't killing people. So what was your experience, and what were the lives of Arabs living and working in Israel? Did you see a dichotomy in the way that they were treated? You know, did they have any kind of grudge or gripe at all?
You know, it was tough, because as individuals, people are people, whether they're Jews or Arabs, and you can meet somebody, let's say a Jew can meet an Arab, and they can really, really like each other, but in the back of their head, there is this suspicion or this fear of, am I going to get stabbed in the back? Is this a pretense? Is this, you know,
okay,
person turn against me?
But I'm still trying to understand the Arab...
Because as individuals, we can really love each other.
Right, right. But I'm just, the whole Arab mindset of what the hell do they have against us? Is it just that they really, really somehow believe that we stole a couple of miles of land? I mean, what is their effing problem?
You know, I have a theory about that.
Great.
This takes 2 to tango. I think it takes at least 3 to tango. In other words, if you and I are fighting, maybe somebody is behind the scenes making us fight. They're whispering sweet things in my ears and in your ears, and they're making us fight. And they tell me, listen, Rabbi Solomon is really dangerous, and, you know, he really doesn't belong here. And then they go to you and go like, oh, this Daphna Levy chick, you know, stay away from her. And next thing you know, you and I are at each other's throat. And I think that's what's happening in the Middle East. There is a lot of money being made on weapons, a lot of money being made on the war. There is somebody there, there are people out there who benefit from the fact that people are killing each other. So they're making sure that people kill each other. I mean, why the hell did they, you know, assassinate Rabin.
That's a great, because that was an Israeli, if people remember. That was a Jewish person who assassinated the so-called peace-loving Yitzhak Rabin, going back a couple of decades. It wasn't an Arab. It wasn't a Muslim terrorist. It was a crazy Yid, unfortunately. Yeah.
That's right, but I don't know. Maybe maybe somebody, you know, like, programmed this guy to go and kill Rabin. You know, it was such a tragedy. And the same with the Egyptian prime minister when he was trying to make peace with Israel.
Hey, you were there. Were you there during the peace process with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin? What was Israel like at that time?
I don't think I was there at the time. I was traveling. I was missing there. I had a few missing years there.
Whoa. This is even more interesting. Where were you, you wild child? Where were you? Missing years, indeed.
I traveled to Europe. I lived in South Africa in 1980. You know, I came. I was in the U.S. a few years. Went back to Israel. Came back here. Yeah, traveled a lot.
Let me. Okay, everything you say brings up another question. So the question now, Daphne Levy, is you're in South Africa for a year. What is the thing between Israel and South Africa back in the time before South Africa righted itself politically and morally, and yet Israel kind of dealt with them? Was it because South Africa would deal with Israel, and Israel just said, hey, we'll look past the racism thing because they'll do business with us?
You know, I don't know. I lived in South Africa during apartheid.
Right.
And it was weird. It was really weird because growing up in Israel, you really, you know, with all the different, with Jews from different parts of the world, you really grow up with a sense of equality, you know, as a Sabra. Equality and appreciation for people. I mean, there are always jokes about every new ethnicity that comes to Israel. There are new jokes, you know, the joke about the Yemeni and the joke about the Moroccans and about the Polish and about the Russians. And there are jokes about everybody.
Well, wait, do you know any good Polish jokes? Do you know any good Polish jokes? I'd love to hear one. Or a Yemeni joke, especially this weekend. Any Yemeni jokes coming to mind?
You know, a Polish joke comes to mind.
Oh, good.
Why does a Polish woman close her eyes when she's making love?
Why?
She cannot stand to see somebody enjoying themselves.
I thought I heard that about a Jewish woman. That's funny. I hear that one about Poland. Okay. So, but again, going back to the South Africa thing, do you think Israel should not have had such open relations with them during those years?
I don't know. I have no opinion about that.
Okay. I mean, did you...
Crazy, you know?
Yeah. Well, you said it was weird when you were living there, of watching the disparate natures of the white and black communities. I mean, did you ever travel and pass things that you just felt in your gut were, like, wrong?
Yeah, for instance, I remember we made friends with some people, with a black person, and then I found out that we could not invite him for a barbecue, A, because it is not appropriate to or acceptable to invite a black person to your home, and B, he wouldn't have had rite of passage because his pass was only good for certain areas of the country. So there was no freedom to travel.
What were you doing in South Africa? How were you supporting yourself, living?
That was with my first husband.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. And his parents had a farm there, so we were there. We went to visit and stayed for a while.
And after South Africa, you went... Yeah, sorry.
For example, it was strange when I wanted to extend my visa, we went to immigration, they refused to extend my visa. And the man there was just furious and so, so rude. He was an Afrikaner, a white, native. And I know he did not extend my visa because being Yemeni, I look somewhat Indian. And the hierarchy of races, there was white, Indian, colored, and black. So I was already a second grade citizen, just by virtue of my looks.
Did you say anything to him? Did you do insult him or give him anything on your way out?
No, I didn't.
Oh, well. Oh, well.
I should have, huh?
All the things that come into your head, you know, 5 minutes later when you're walking to the airport. You know? By the way, we are talking with Daphna Levy, or Daphna Levy Hernandez, if you want to use her married name. She is a relationship expert and a life coach, the author of the book Picking Right, which is all about picking the right person to live with, to marry, to be with. We'll go back a little bit to your autobiography, but I think it's only fair to ask a couple more questions about what you do. And let me ask you, what are some mistakes that couples make that ruin a marriage?
Well, secrets is the number one mistake.
Okay.
Secrets build walls between people. Let's say I bought a dress for $100 and I told him it was really $75 because I knew he'd be mad that I spent that much money. It is stupid. It is stupid because, first of all, if you have a secret, you have to have good memory.
Mm.
What did I say? You know, how much did I, you know?
And you tell one lie and it snowballs and it snowballs and suddenly it's a whole avalanche.
Yeah, yeah. And it distances you from each other. It's
true.
Not necessary. Just keep it simple. Keep it truthful.
So,
makes life so much easier.
Go to her and say, yes, I shtuck your sister.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't stook your sister, her sister. That'll be easier. Which, that brings me to a rule that I have in my marriage, is I never do anything that I wouldn't want to tell my husband about.
Okay. Hmm. Is that, again, is that easier said than done?
Actually, it's easier than the other way around. It's much easier than having secrets and little goobers in the relationships that you are stuck with.
Did you say goobers?
Out of work. I said goobers.
Goobers. I like that. I like that. Okay. And what's one more thing that couples do that they shouldn't do that damages marriages and relationships?
They shouldn't compete with each other on, oh, you know, I did this for you, so what are you going to do for me? The competition should be the other way. You're like, how much can I do for you? Can I do for you more than you do for me? And when you have that kind of competition, oh my Lord, you really, really help each other.
Huh. Wow. Okay. Boy! You see, I've been married to my dear wife, Miriam Libby, for a few years now, and we have 27 and a half children. And everything you've said is, we've been doing the opposite. So tomorrow I'm going to wake up, I'm going to change everything. I'm actually going to be nice to her, or try. I'll see if it works. I'll give it a day.
Give it a day, 24 hours, see what happens.
Yeah, you know what, I'll even give it 25 hours. That's the kind of man I am. I'll see if it turns around.
I'm gonna sleep throughout the time.
That's right. Say, now here's a question. I asked you before about a success story of your telling a couple, you know, do this, and try, here's this, and boom, and things got better. Do you have any failure stories? Any time that you thought you were helping and the guy went home and blew his wife's head off?
They're always failure stories. When you venture into the field of helping people, you're gonna win some, you're gonna lose some.
That's fair.
That's just gonna be the thing. So, but the successes and the wins just make it all worthwhile. And if you don't try to help, then nobody will be bettered for it. And the thing is that if you stop helping, you just deteriorate. We live to help. I believe that we live to help. That's why we're here.
Hmm.
And our value is to the extent that we help. Proportional.
Now, let me ask you, you are based out in California. Do you travel? I mean, how do people get in touch with you if they want your help?
mean, if somebody paid me enough, I'll travel. Okay, otherwise, they travel to see me.
Somebody pays me enough, I'll do a lot more than travel. My God. The things I would do for money. But they can buy your book, of course, and they can go to your website, which is lifecoachingmasters.com.
There is a simple one. They can go to pickingright.com.
Oh.
And they can sign up for a free relationship tips and free book excerpts, and they can email me through the site, just pickingright.com.
Pickingright.com. Great. Okay, that is helpful. Now, let me ask you. Now, let's get back to the autobiography. So, you're leaving South Africa to go where?
At that point, I went back to Israel after having been gone for some years.
Okay. And then you were still with your husband, or did you divorce in South Africa, or what? When did that end?
I was still with my husband, and we divorced later when we were in Israel.
So, why did you leave Israel to come to America?
In 1985, having traveled the world and having lived in Israel, U.S., South Africa, and crossed Europe, I decided that if I had to choose a place, if I had a choice of where I was going to spend the rest of my life, it would be in California. So I came back to L.A., came back to the United States.
And that's where you have stayed now for quite a few years. So, how does California, I mean, you were talking about safety and other issues, California versus Israel, what's good, what's bad?
The weather is comparable, which I love. I love the weather in this latitude. Safety, as I said, most parts of Israel are safer than L.A. at night. I live in a beautiful town called Pasadena. I have my office here. I will not go out at 10 o'clock and walk.
Really?
Be uncomfortable.
Now,
it creeps around.
Now, the nice thing is that you are... Do you have any degrees, by the way? I mean, you finished high school, you went into the Army. Did you go to college? Do you have any degrees in psychology and therapy, anything like that?
I actually refused to go to college.
Why did you refuse to go to college?
Because I'm a defiant Israeli.
But what did you think college was going to do to you?
I just looked at it and I said, I was 20 years old, I'd been through high school, I military, the whole thing, and my whole life had been planned for me by the society, because I had to do, I had to go to school, I had to go to high school, I had to go to the military and so forth. And I was like, up to here was having other people tell me what to do with my life. And I looked at college and I said, I don't want to know anything that they teach. You know, in the military, I was a teacher. I was a tutor. At the time, the military had a corps that was called the Teachers Corps. And you could only join it by volunteering, providing you had the aptitude. So after boot camp, they gave us our choices, and then they posted us in our respective places, and I chose the Teachers Corps. Well, I wind up for 2 years I was actually stationed in Sderot. You know that little town that was bombed very heavily recently with the Gaza Strip?
Oh, Sderot, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I was stationed for 2 years.
Wow.
At the time, Sderot was, it was very, very quiet, safe little town, you know. It was like a little village almost. I taught women from North Africa, Tunis, Algeria, Morocco, and so forth, who were not quite new immigrants, but they were immigrants. I taught them how to read and write Hebrew, how to speak Hebrew more properly. And because even though they've been in the country for a while, they already had kids and so forth, they were stay-at-home moms and they were not very educated and they never took the time to really learn the language. So us, the teachers, we used to go to their homes and sit with these women. And I developed fantastic relationships with these ladies. They loved me like family, and here I was, 18, 19 years old, and I would come and they would share their their problems and the stories about the kids and the husband and the wedding night and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And in a way, my work was a little bit like social work. And I saw that I was not really making a big difference in these people's lives, because I would come back after a Passover break or some kind of holiday break, and there was nothing changed. They would still have the same problems with the children and the husband and the language. And I felt like I was on a hamster on a wheel.
I gotcha.
So that disabused me of any aspiration I had previously had to be a psychologist or a social worker or something. I said, no, there got to be something better. So there was nothing in college that I wanted to learn, so I said, I'm going to skip college. Just because everybody goes to college doesn't mean I need to go to college.
But what you do now is combination social worker, therapist, helper, shoulder the cry on, etc., isn't it?
It is, except I have figured out ways to give people advice that really helps. And I think I have a great advantage in the fact that I did not go to college, because when you get overly educated, you stop thinking for yourself. And some of the people I've coached who were the hardest to coach were people who were very educated with PhDs. Oh my God, are they stupid sometimes?
Okay. They
have no more originality. They have no more free thinking. They're just educated. You know what I mean?
I've run into that, because I was occasionally involved with the university here, and I see I see the smart ones, and then I see the ones who are too smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Too many years of just answering exams and papers and not thinking and creating for me. Like, one great way to ruin an artist is to send them to college for too many years. They just can't create anymore.
Now, speaking of creating, what gave you the impetus? What made you think, aha, it's time for me to write a book?
I noticed that even when I was coaching an entrepreneur or a business person or an artist, and they were extremely talented and doing well in their life, in their art, in their business, relationships always interfere. They have another broken marriage, another broken relationship. They get distracted by relationships. So it became my expertise, because I always had to somehow fit it in and straighten out their relationships, or help them straighten out their relationships so they can carry on and do well with their career.
Uh-huh.
And then I found out that many times when the relationship was beyond repair, it's because they picked wrong. So I said, I'm going to write a book called Picking Right, The Single's Guide to Finding the Right Match. And, you got to have somebody who matches. And if it doesn't match, it's really, really hard to fix it later, because it was wrong in the first place. Have you ever met a couple that you said, like, what the heck are they doing together?
Oh, my God. Just every time I wake up in the morning and look at my dear wife, Miriam Libby, what am I telling you? But there's a quote from you that says, marrying for love is a mistake. Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because if it's the wrong match, it's like the Tina Turner song, what's love got to do with it? If you, for example, let's say you have somebody, he wants 10 kids and he wants a big family, and she is a ballerina, and she wants to dance until she's 40. Well, she's not going to have time to have 10 kids.
That's right, yeah. Unless she'd be a very odd-looking ballerina, I'll tell you.
That's right. So then they're both frustrated. She can't, he blames her because she can't do her art, and she accuses him because now she didn't do her art because she was having babies, and they're going to wind up miserable.
So even though they were madly in love, if their certain other aspects were incompatible, it's doomed, basically.
That's right.
So what are things that people can do when they're embarking on a relationship or a potential serious relationship that they should be on the lookout for?
First of all, they should look at what they want out of life. Sometimes people don't know what they want out of life, so they need to work on themselves and figure it out first.
Okay.
What do you want out of a life? Does it align with what I want out of life? Doesn't have to be the same thing, but it can clash.
I want money, cars, and hookers. Very hard to find a woman who would, agree with me on that, unfortunately.
You're in trouble, Rabbi.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know, yeah.
Miriam Libby must be a saint.
Well, wrong religion, but yeah, whatever the Jewish equivalent of sainthood would be.
There you go.
But does that mean I get to kill her? So she can become one? But what's another thing that, that you, if you're starting on something you want to see or you want to think about?
Another thing is emotional level. In other words, for example, you're a very dynamic person.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, right? Okay. Now, let's say that you had a spouse who was very mellow and apathetic and slow and, you would drive each other crazy.
True.
She wouldn't be able to keep up with you. She wouldn't be able to, she would drive you up the wall because, like, come on, wake up.
It's like marrying Mr. Rogers. I get it. Okay, so you've got to be, again, compatible. I mean, that's really the word. It's the cliche, but that's the word.
Yeah, that is the word. But what does this kind of break down what compatibility means? It means compatibility in terms of goals, compatibility in terms of emotional attitude toward life.
Hmm.
You have a very dynamic, energetic person with somebody who's very low energy. That'll be hell on earth.
That's right. So speaking of hell on earth, Daphne Levy, the Palestinians, having lived in Israel, yes, we're jumping back to this now. Do you agree with a two-state solution? Do you think that's just nonsense and a smokescreen? Do you see there being peace in anybody's lifetime? Your thoughts.
I think there's not going to be peace until both sides realize that a third side is causing the conflict.
Well, you mentioned that. But do you really think that both Israel and the Arabs are equally to blame?
Well, you know, being Israeli, I'm a little biased.
I would hope so.
In the direction of what I've seen. I tell you the difference between the Israelis and the Arabs. The difference is that the Arabs are indoctrinated to hate. And I have good friends here in L.A. who are Arab, and I'm friends with the whole family, and we're very close. It's amazing how much more in common we have than I would have even with an American. Just culturally, food-wise, music, so forth. And I was talking to one of them the other day, and she admitted, and she said, yes, we were educated to hate. It's in the educational system. They teach us to hate. And when I told her, she said, how about you? And I said, no, we were raised on Song of Peace. We were raised on prayer for a better world. And she said, really? And in fact, I'm going to translate for her a few of the songs, the common popular songs that I grew up with, of, you know, one day there will be peace and so on. That's the difference. And I think it makes it very, very hard because the Arabs are educated to hate and we are educated to be wary of them.
Hey, I'm just shocked that you said, yeah, the Palestinians are educated. Ba-dum-bum-tsh. But just a little racist humor there. But so do you think, let's say the Arabs get their own little state there. Do you think that's going to do anything except make Israel more dangerous?
No, I think it won't do anything unless we really resolve what's at the bottom. Which is, I'll change the word educated to brainwashed.
Okay. So they're, yeah, so I'm just saying, you know, the liberal media and God help us, the Jewish liberal media is all like, oh, well, you know, we took the land, and so let's give them back the land, and then they'll be happy, and they'll have their own state, and they'll govern themselves, and everything will be wonderful, and there'll be peace. I say bullshit. I honestly say
bullshit. I agree
bullshit.
With you, because, listen, my history in Israel, growing up in Israel, is like, we take land, we give it back. We take land, we give it. We give it back, and 10 years later, we have to have another war, you know, to defend our homes. And then we gain some land, and then we have to give it back. And then we have peace for 10 years. You know, yeah, that's a story. I agree with you completely. It is BS.
Oh boy,
taking land is not what's going to make the war, the peace.
It's just it's re-educating, unbrainwashing, which is virtually impossible. So that's why I just don't think there will ever be. I think there'll be a nuclear war before we'll have peace with the Arabs. I really, unfortunately, believe that.
Yeah. Well, I hope that maybe on a grassroots level, we're going to get to a point where the brainwashing will cease.
I just, I hope so. I think, you know, the Jews, the Israelis, and the Arabs, and the Western countries should all get together and learn to hate the Koreans. That's really my, if we all do that, we just target them, I think we'll all be in better shape.
We won't have time to hate each other.
Just kidding. This is the fruit stamps. They make me mad.
At least we can't fight with them, and we'll have somebody to hate, but there will be no war on Earth. That's a solution.
There you go. We have been talking with the delightful, the charming, and the very, very smart, and without even a college education, smarter than most college people I've ever met, Daphna Levy. Remember that her book is called Picking Right. Remember that her website is called pickingright.com. Remember that she will help you with your relationships, with your lives. So, last question for you, Daphna. And I'm going to go back to the Israel thing, having, as you said, lived there for so many years and visited there since then. What's a common misperception about Israel that people in the West and maybe non-Jews would have?
The most common one is that Israel is dangerous.
Mm.
I meet so many people who say, I would love to visit Christians who learn, read about the holy places throughout their lives, and oh, if I could only see the Sea of Galilee and Bethlehem and all this, and they go like, oh, but it's too dangerous, I can't go. Like, come on, it's more dangerous to drive the freeway in the U.S. than it is to go visit Israel.
This is what I was. This is absolutely a true thing. I was in a diner yesterday. Honest to gosh, I was in the diner and I was listening to a couple of older Goyisha women. And they're talking about travel and people and watching Rick Steves on TV, the guy who goes to all the churches because he's a Goy. And they're saying, oh, yes, I have a friend and she wanted to go to Israel and she was really, really wanting to go. And all her friends were telling them, no, don't go, it's too dangerous, don't go, don't she didn't go. Literally, I heard this yesterday in the diner. Meanwhile, what they were saying is, oh, you know where we really like to go? Paris. I mean, you know, what can you say to that?
There you go.
This is not a joke. This actually, I swear to Hashem, this happened the other day in the diner. This is the conversation I overheard. But anyway.
Oh, I believe you. I was in Israel a few years ago, and my brother is a biker. My brother is 72 years old. He rides a Harley.
Okay.
So part of the Harley Club of Israel. So he took me on a two-day ride to the Negev, to the desert. And there was like a whole caravan, like 50 Harleys riding through the desert. Of course, it was during the Passover. It was the hottest days of the year. I don't know why they chose to go south instead of north, but it was still, you know, we were baking. And it was fantastic. We rode through the desert. We had security, you know, leading us everywhere. We got to this place. We spent the night in a Bedouin tent. There were camels. We ate, you know, like the Arabs eat, you know, on the plates on the floor and all this on the rugs. It was fantastic, and it was so safe. It was just so. It was safer than I would feel driving through Nevada.
Really? Wow! Get your motor running. Get out on the Negev. Looking for some camels. You really are born to be wild, aren't you, Daphna Levy? What a it's a little 60s musical quote there. But it has been delightful talking with you about your life, your work, your years in Israel. All I can wish you is much more success, success that you bring to other people in what you do, and of course, in your own life. Daphna Levy, what a joy it has been to have you in the neighborhood. Shalom to you.
Shalom. Thank you so much.